Okay, let's begin our afternoon session. In the afternoon sessions, the first two of the afternoon sessions, we're going to be focusing on the cultivating emotional balance. But before I launch into introduction into emotional balance, let's maybe just review a little bit what we've talked about this morning. So we are focusing on two main areas in this retreat is cultivating mindfulness and then cultivating this emotional balance. And we saw that within mindfulness, that word coming from the original Buddhist context really means to remember the object. So mindfulness is really our ability to focus on a given object without becoming distracted. So really we're talking about improving our attention skills, developing our ability to focus or concentrate. And so within that practice, we saw that there are primarily these two qualities of stability and clarity that we're trying to cultivate. A stable mind, to be able to focus without becoming distracted, but also to focus in a very clear way, overcoming dullness. So we need a very stable and clear mind. But as we saw this morning, this needs to be based on relaxation. Because if we don't have a relaxed mind, if we're very tight and tense in our focus, it's going to be impossible to develop stability and clarity in any sustainable way. We're going to get with a lot of tightness and tension in our focus, of course we're going to get a lot of fatigue, a lot of agitation. It's not really going to work. So very important in this training that we first learn how to relax. Relax, relax, relax. Not only the body, but relaxing the mind as a basis for our training. And we saw there that this mindfulness training is going to bring us a lot of benefits. Because if we can really develop a very calm, clear, focused mind, then of course we're going to be much more effective in everything we do. Much less stress, a much more calm mind, much less mental agitation, mental imbalance. We're also going to find that we actually start to enjoy the simple pleasures in life more than we do now. But also, of course, we are going to really develop that very calm, clear mind. We're going to really become the masters of our mind instead of the slaves of our mind, as we often are now. And also, of course, this calm, clear, focused mind is going to be a very good basis for then developing this emotional balance and striving for what's called genuine happiness, which is what we're going to be looking at in this session. So this is a little bit of the mindfulness training, and we're going to continue to look at various aspects of this mindfulness training in the last session this afternoon. So far we've looked at how really to prepare ourselves well at the beginning of the meditation in terms of preparing the body, nice, relaxed, still body, really bringing the breathing into the natural rhythm, maybe doing a little breathing exercise if we come into the meditation with a little bit of a negative state of mind, bringing the mind into the present moment, setting a good motivation. So with these preparatory practices, then we can really start to develop these qualities here. In the last session this afternoon, we're going to look at what sorts of objects we can use in this training, what are the main tools we use in the practice, and then how to overcome various faults in our practice. So these are still to come later this afternoon. So what I'd like to do now then is to have a look at the cultivating emotional balance. So maybe I'll leave that on the board for later so we can spin this around. So here when we're talking about cultivating emotional balance, Actually, what we can really begin to look at is what's called four balances. So I think all of you hopefully should have received this article here. Dipankar, I think, sent this to you all. So this is an article co-written by Alan Wallace, and he's talking here about mental balance and well-being. And in here, he talks about four types of balance that are really indispensable. So here, of course, in this retreat, we're focusing on two of those. We're focusing on cultivating mindfulness, which he calls here attentional balance, and then, of course, emotional balance. But if we really want to cultivate those well, we need to have an integrated, holistic approach. And so he talks here about four types of balance. And the first one is motivational balance. And what this is all about is having healthy aspirations and desires. Mindfulness, of course, is becoming very popular in our modern day world and can bring benefits. But unfortunately, a lot of the time in the modern day world, mindfulness training is presented as an isolated topic without even ever addressing these things. So what happens then, of course, is a lot of the reason mindfulness is popular in the modern day is because we have a lot of issues and problems of stress and anxiety and so forth. And so then this mindfulness is used to sort of pacify that a little bit. But of course, if we don't address this, if we have unhealthy aspirations and desires, then mindfulness training is like putting a band-aid on a festering wound. It's not really going to give us much benefit. So unless we treat the underlying problems, then mindfulness practice on its own is really not going to bring us a lot in our life. It'll temporarily soothe our agitated, disturbed, stressed mind, but then we continue to indulge in actions and aspirations and desires which are completely unhealthy for us. So then they're working against each other. So very important that we really address this, what's called motivational balance, to develop very healthy aspirations and desires in our life. Otherwise, our mindfulness practice is not really going to take us very far. Maybe I'll mention all the four and then have a look at them in more detail. Then we have what's called attentional balance, and this, of course, is what we begin to discuss our practice of mindfulness. So in attentional balance, then, we're developing the ability to see clearly, developing this very calm, clear, focused mind. Then we're going to look at a little bit at what's called cognitive balance. And cognitive balance is our to see clearly, objectively, to see reality as it is. Because a lot of our problems in our life comes because of not seeing things clearly, of projecting our own ideas, projecting a lot of things onto the things we perceive that are not really there, existing there in reality. So of course we need to be able to see things objectively and clearly to have emotional or mental balance. And so emotional balance, of course, is seeing clearly subjectively, having that aspect of interacting with things in a very, very healthy way, in a very healthy subjective way. So let's have a look at each one of those in a little bit more detail and how they sort of work together as a sort of a framework or package. First off, motivational balance. And here I can give a couple of short sort of definitions that sort of come from this and from Alan Wallace's work. Motivational balance, it says, motivational balance results from reality-based desires and intentions that are oriented towards one's own and others' happiness. So maybe we can write those down. And here we can, relating to this, we can have a quote from His Holiness Dalai Lama. And His Holiness Dalai Lama says, "I believe the very purpose of life is to seek happiness. Whether one believes in religion or not, whether one believes in this religion or that religion, we are all seeking something better in life. So I think the very motion of our life is towards happiness." And I think that's true. I think we all are striving for happiness and striving to be free of suffering. But here, to understand this, we need to appreciate that we can talk about at least two types of happiness. There's what's called temporal happiness and genuine happiness. Temporal happiness, of course, is the happiness we receive from some stimulus. So, of course, this is what we would call pleasure. And this is a stimulus-based happiness. meaning we need some sort of stimulus to have some pleasurable experience. So, of course, there's nothing wrong with this, but from a Buddhist perspective, if we are focusing on this as the method or the direction of trying to fulfill our life, we're never going to get very far. Because this stimulus-based happiness, again, is a temporary happiness. It requires a stimulus for us to have it. There's no stimulus, there's no pleasure. And then, of course, we often then grasp onto these pleasurable experiences, hoping that they're going to last and fulfill us. So not only are they only temporary experiences that come to an end, but we induce a lot of unnecessary suffering on ourselves by hoping that they last and trying to hold on to them. And then, of course, when they don't last and they finish, we get upset, we get depressed and all sorts of things. So, therefore, from a Buddhist perspective, striving for this is never really going to fulfill our life. Whereas the genuine happiness that we often talk about within Buddhism is a not stimulus-based happiness. So genuine happiness is not happiness that is stimulus-based. It's a state of well-being that does not depend on any particular stimulus to be present. And from a Buddhist perspective, this type of happiness comes from developing ourselves, developing our own mind. And usually there are three elements that are listed as core elements for striving for genuine happiness. First, and the foundation, is ethics, to have an ethical lifestyle, to stop harming others. The second element is often referred to as concentration. Which actually is relating to our mindfulness training, our attentional balance. And the third element here is wisdom. And that is very much related to this cognitive balance. Because from a Buddhist perspective, the underlying source of our suffering is our mistaken view of reality, that we are not seeing things clearly, objectively. We are not seeing clearly how we exist and the world around us exists, and this is what's leading to this mental imbalance of having a craving and attachment for pleasant things, having aversion for unpleasant things. All of our mental afflictions and all of our suffering is coming from this. So if we want to strive for this genuine happiness, we need to really transform our mind. The basis is ethical lifestyle. Sanskrit, of course, this is Shila. The training in concentration often is referred to as samadhi. And of course, wisdom is prajna. So, through doing these core elements of training, which reflect back on these balances here, then we can really transform our mind and we can strive for this state of genuine happiness. It's a state of inner well-being that does not require any particular stimulus to be present. So
I've got another short definition here of this genuine happiness. It says, without dependence on pleasant stimuli, genuine happiness is a state of well-being that arises from one's ethical, benevolent way of life, from the cultivation of exceptional mental balance, and from wisdom, especially entailing insight into one's own nature. So, therefore, when we talk about striving for happiness, we can talk about these two types of happiness. And that the temporal happiness, at best, it will give us some temporary pleasurable experiences. At worst, we will simply induce a lot of unnecessary suffering by trying to grasp onto these pleasant experiences and be frustrated when we don't get them, disappointed when they finish, upset, and just crave for more. So, therefore, here, when we talk about motivational balance, healthy aspirations and desires, if our underlying aspiration and desire is, I want more pleasure, I want more money, I want more stuff, then I think we're going to be stuck. We're not really going to get very far, and our attentional training and emotional training will get sabotaged because of very unhealthy aspirations or desires in our life. Any questions about that? Motivational balance. Or? Not sure. I don't know. Okay. So then, in terms of healthy aspirations and desires, then this stimulus-based happiness is really about what we can get from the world. And if we have those sorts of aspirations and desires of wanting to have more stuff, more pleasure and so forth, then, of course, the world is going to seem very user-unfriendly because there's going to be a lot of things out there that's going to interfere with that. Whereas if we have a more healthy aspiration and desire to strive for genuine happiness in terms of having an ethical lifestyle, balancing our mind, developing this wisdom and the emotional balance, then through that we can develop this state of inner well-being and happiness that does not require any particular stimulus to be present for us to be in that state of well-being. And also, here, of course, this is more about then what we can bring to the world rather than what we can get from the world. So with this, the world will appear much more user-friendly because even difficult situations in our life can be seen as opportunities for us to develop more our qualities and to help others. So there's going to be that very much difference there as well. Okay. So that's the first one, the motivational balance. So unless we address that as the underlying thing, unless we really develop these healthy aspirations and desires in our life, then all of the other three, in particular the ones we're focusing on, attentional training, the mindfulness training and emotional balance, will really be sabotaged and really won't bring us much in our life. And then, of course, the attentional balance, which we're already starting to look at, is this mindfulness training, is simply to develop a calm, clear, focused mind so that we can see things clearly, the ability to see clearly with this very calm, clear, focused mind. Then, of course, we can talk about what's called cognitive balance. Now, cognitive balance here is, as the name suggests here, seeing clearly objectively. And here we can, another short definition of cognitive balance, it says, cognitive balance involves engaging with the world of experience without projecting assumptions or ideas which cause us to misapprehend reality. Because if we are not seeing reality or the world of our experience in a very clear, objective way, clearly, objectively, if we are not seeing that, then the way in which we interact with the world will be dysfunctional and create problems for us. And I just want to briefly touch on two aspects here, because this is a very huge topic within Buddhism. We're really talking about this wisdom practice. And from a Buddhist perspective, the underlying source of all of our suffering is because we don't see clearly objectively. It's because of this fundamental ignorance that I briefly mentioned this morning, this misperception of how things exist, how we exist and how the world around us exists. And we project onto this reality false ideas. And there are a number of ways in which we can distort or project onto reality. I just want to briefly mention two that may be helpful to you. First is the idea of impermanence, in Sanskrit of course anicca, or in Pali anicca. And impermanence here is really talking about the fact that things are changing from moment to moment, the transitory nature of everything we experience. Of course, this is not something that we have to established, because this is something that's been proven within science community. It's been proven scientific fact that things are changing moment by moment. And I think we all learned this at school, and I think none of us have any problem with accepting the idea of impermanence. But of course the question is, even though intellectually we may accept impermanence, is that how we experientially see the things around us? Do we experience things in this way? No. For example, you know, when we look at this cup here, intellectually we all know this is changing moment by moment. Experientially, is that how we see this cup? No. Experientially, this is more or less the same cup that was here yesterday, it'll be the same cup here tomorrow. So experientially, we are projecting stability onto this object when there is no stability there. And that is a scientific fact. So our behaviour is not driven by our intellectual understanding. Our behaviour is driven by our instinctive habits. And our instinctive habits experientially is telling me this is very quite stable. It's more or less the same cup that was here yesterday. It'll be more or less the same cup here tomorrow. So, therefore, we don't have cognitive balance in our experience. We are projecting stability onto something that has no stability whatsoever. And we are interacting with these things based on that invalid assumption that things are stable. And that's why a lot of our mental afflictions arise. You know, when we're going to look at attachment and aversion and anger. Attachment is seeing things as stable. So if it's giving us some pleasure, then we are seeing this as quite stable. This will continue to give me pleasure, and so we try and hold on to it. And so therefore that's feeding the attachment. If we can bring this intellectual idea
if we can develop cognitive balance by experientially seeing things as changing moment by moment, our life would dramatically improve. If experientially we saw things as really in a constant state of flux and change, attachment has nothing to grab hold of. What's there to grab? There's nothing stable and static to hold on to. It's constantly changing. So if we can start to work with cognitive balance by bringing this intellectual understanding into experience through meditation, if we can internalize this intellectual idea, then we'll start to have this cognitive balance. We'll start to experientially see things as changing moment by moment, and thereby dramatically reduce our reactive tendencies to pleasant and unpleasant things of attachment and aversion, and thereby reduce immensely a lot of sufferings and problems that we have in our life. So that's one way of developing this cognitive balance, by really experientially seeing things as changing moment by moment. Another way, and this is a deeper level of really developing cognitive balance, is this idea of interdependency. Again, intellectually, we can sort of appreciate that things are dependent on many things. This clock here is existing depending on many causes and conditions. It exists on depending on the various parts. It exists depending on many factors. So intellectually, we can appreciate that everything is existing dependent on many other factors, the idea of interdependency. But experientially, is this how we see things? Do we see things as really being this interdependent world? Or do we see the world experientially as a lot of separate, discrete, independent things? I think that's how we see the world. There's an independent me here, there's a separate independent clock there, there's a separate independent ball there. Everything, the world seems to be made up of many separate, discrete, independent entities. And that's the basis upon which we act. But intellectually, we know this is crazy to think like this, that this world of interdependency, we just have to look at things like climate change and all these things, to see that everything is interdependent. And we sort of understand it intellectually, but the problem again is that as long as we leave these ideas as intellectual ideas, they don't affect us, because our behaviour is not driven by our intellectual understanding. We need to internalise those, we need to come to experientially see things as that way. Then we can really have cognitive balance. We can really experientially see things as in a constant state of flux and change, and that everything is interdependent. If we can experientially see things in this way, 100%, from a Buddhist perspective, we've overcome all suffering. We're liberated from suffering. So I think we can now start to try to really internalize, better understand these ideas, of course, but then start to internalize them, and in our daily life, try to really see things in this way. And you'll find that if you start to see things in this way in daily life, a lot of our problems and sufferings would just disappear. But this is a huge topic within Buddhism, particularly this idea here, and beyond the scope of this initial training. So I just want to sort of leave it there for now. I'll touch on these points a couple of times in the coming days as well. But if there's any questions now on this, before we move on to the emotional balance. Yeah, it's a very long word, but... Yeah, that's it. And of course the flip side to this of interdependency is the fact that nothing's independent, and that is usually often how it's referred to in Buddhism, is this idea of emptiness, or in Sanskrit, shunyata. So that's sort of the flip side of interdependency. This is saying nothing exists independently, everything exists dependently. So they're like two sides of the coin. So when we talk, usually we use both of these ways of speaking. Yeah. Here, of course, I didn't want to really bring that in because it's another level of projecting. That we also project onto ourselves. You know, of course there's a me, there's a person here, but we project onto ourselves that we exist in a more solid, stable way than we really exist. And within a Buddhist perspective, that is projecting what's called self. So within Buddhism, self doesn't mean me or person. Self is an overinflated, false sense of me. So that's another projection. So, you know, we're projecting stability onto things that are not stable, we're projecting independence on things that are not independent, and we're projecting onto ourselves that there is this stable, solid me that doesn't exist but in that way. So that's another way of falsely projecting, yes. So we'll leave it there. Yeah. The act of observing reality. Yes. So remember, this idea of interdependency means there is no independent observer and independent reality that's being observed. So this question is a bit sort of not really a bit new, this question, because the question is, you know, are we, as an independent observer, affecting this reality we're observing? From a Buddhist perspective, that doesn't exist. So you can only have observer with observer. And so they are interdependent. So in that sense, of course, they relate as relatives to each other. Okay.
And then emotional balance is, as we saw earlier this morning, one way of defining that, it says here again, emotional balance is achieved when one has awareness of one's own and others' emotions, emotional triggers and emotional behaviours as they arise, and making wise choices while engaging with emotional experience. So again, if we want emotional balance, it says here we need to have awareness of our own and others' emotional states and so forth. So this is it, attentional balance. And we need to wise choices while engaging with emotional experience. So we need all of these three things if we really want to develop emotional balance. And within that emotional balance, as I said, now we tend to be stimulus reaction machines. We don't see things clearly, objectively. We have unhealthy aspirations and desires. We have very little mindfulness. So we're really just stimulus reaction machines based on a lot of our old habits, which are not very constructive and healthy. We're not seeing things very clearly.
So based on these three things not being in balance, then we end up with emotional imbalance. We have a lot of mental afflictions, attachment, aversion, anger, jealousy, OCD, all sorts of things. And so if we can really develop those healthy apprehensions and desires, we can have mindfulness to be aware, we can see things clearly using our wisdom, then we can really develop this emotional balance. And then instead of reacting in a very harmful way, we can respond using these two aspects of the wisdom and the compassion. So in this emotional balance training, we're going to be looking at some of the ways in which we react in terms of attachment, aversion, anger, and so forth. We're going to look at why we do that and how to deal with that. And then we're going to look at, in particular, in terms of then responding wisely, we're going to look at this compassion wing, the loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. We're going to look at those qualities which tie back into our motivational balance. We're going to look at what those qualities are and how we go cultivating them. So we're going to look at how to overcome our emotional imbalances and then how to cultivate more emotional balance based on that. So that's what we're going to be looking at in the coming days. So, of course, you know, we all want to be happy, but again, we tend to equate happiness with pleasure. And because we don't have this cognitive balance, particularly because we're not seeing things as interdependent, we are seeing things as a me here and there's a world out there, and I want more happiness, meaning I want more pleasure. So what do we do, of course, is the source of our happiness and source of our suffering seems to be out there in that supposed independent world, which doesn't exist, but we believe that. And so then we end up with a lot of attachment and craving for pleasant experiences. We have a lot of aversion to unpleasant experiences. And so this is one of the main techniques we use to strive to be happy, is we try to get more pleasure and we try to avoid any unpleasant situations, avoid or push away. But of course, is this really getting us any closer to genuine happiness? I mean, we've been using this technique for many, many years. Are we any closer to becoming happy and being free of suffering? If these things out there were really the source of our happiness, it would really mean the people who have the most of these things would be the most happy. You know, so sort of using this logic, the most wealthy people should be the most happy people, but we see that that's usually not the case. They're usually quite often quite miserable. And there's a very nice quote here, again from this great Indian Buddhist master Shantideva from the 8th century, talking about using this approach for happiness. He says, "Those seeking to escape from suffering hasten right toward their own misery. And with the very desire for happiness, out of delusion, they destroy their own well-being as if it were the enemy." I think that's pretty true. So, what I'd like to do now, before we go for an afternoon tea break, is just do a short meditation, reflecting a little bit on this idea of happiness, particularly this sort of temporal happiness versus genuine happiness. So let's do a short meditation for about 15 minutes and then we'll have an afternoon tea break.
to allow your awareness to descend into the body. Simply becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. We can take 3 slow, deep breaths, maintaining awareness of sensations throughout the body as we breathe. And allow the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply allowing it to flow naturally, effortlessly. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. And without dwelling in the past, and without anticipating the future, simply allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Wherever you most distinctly notice sensations associated with the breath, we all want to be happy, and we all want to be free of problems and suffering. But what is the source of our happiness? And what is the source of our suffering? It often seems to us as if the source of our happiness and the source of our suffering is out there in the world. So one of the main methods we often use to try to find happiness and to try to overcome our suffering is that we try to manipulate the world around us. We try to attract people, places, and things that seem to be the source of our happiness. And we try to push away or avoid people, places, and things that seem to be the source of our suffering. However, is this an effective strategy? Are we getting any closer to achieving genuine happiness and overcoming suffering if we adopt this strategy? No matter how hard we try to do this manipulation, we still seem to encounter suffering, and we're still chasing after that elusive happiness. We're simply trapping ourselves in the hope-fear cycle, hoping for pleasant experiences, fearing or worrying about unpleasant experiences. And if we don't get the things we want, we often become very frustrated. And even if we get the things we want, we're never really satisfied, and we simply end up craving for more. and we often end up with a lot of dissatisfaction when things don't live up to our expectations. So what's the solution? According to Buddhism, we're looking in the wrong place. What would happen if we turned our attention to our own mind? What would happen if we began to cultivate more mindfulness? If we developed a more calm, clear, focused mind? And what would happen if we could start to see things more clearly without projecting or distorting what we apprehend? And what would happen if we reduced our mental afflictions, such as anger, craving, jealousy, anxiety, and depression? And we began to cultivate loving kindness and compassion for ourselves and others. And instead of reacting to things out of old habits, we could begin to respond in ways more conducive to our own and others' happiness. And what would happen if we could see difficult situations in our life as opportunities for growth, rather than seeing them as problems or obstacles? So let's set a motivation of wishing to discover practical methods to overcome suffering and to find genuine happiness. and we can extend that motivation out to include others. Also wishing to help those around us to overcome suffering and to find happiness. You can bring the meditation to a close. So let's have an afternoon tea break and come back at 3:30. And we'll have a look at attachment in the next session.